is a part of yours. Thanks.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Mario Ritter Jr., Faith Perlow, and Dan Friedel. Later, Anna Mateo will bring us this week's words and their stories. But first, here is John Russell.
United States astronaut Mark VandeHei has made it through nearly a year in space. Now he faces an unusual situation. At the end of the month, he is going to ride a Russian spacecraft back to Earth as tensions deepen between the countries. VandeHei, who recently broke the U.S. single spaceflight record of 340 days, is due to leave the International Space Station, or ISS, with two Russians in a Soyuz capsule. They will land in Kazakhstan on March 30th. The astronaut will have spent 355 days in space by then, setting a new U.S. record. The world record of 438 continuous days in space belongs to Russia. NASA insists VandeHei's return plans at the end of the month remain unchanged, even as Russia's invasion of Ukraine has resulted in canceled launches, broken contracts, and a war of words with the Russian space agency's leader, Dmitry Rogozin. Retired NASA astronaut Scott Kelly is among those arguing with Rogozin, a longtime ally of Vladimir Putin. Angered by what is going on in Ukraine, Kelly has returned his Russian Medal for Space Exploration to the Russian Embassy in Washington. Despite the conflict on Earth, Kelly believes the two sides can hold it together up in space. He told the Associated Press, "We need an example set that two countries that historically have not been on the most friendly of terms can still work somewhere peacefully. And that somewhere is the International Space Station. That's why we need to fight to keep it. NASA wants to keep the space station running until 2030, as do the European, Japanese, and Canadian space agencies, while the Russians have not committed beyond the original end date of 2024. The U.S. and Russia are the main operators of the ISS, which has been permanently occupied for 21 years. Until SpaceX started launching astronauts in 2020, Americans regularly got rides on Russian Soyuz capsules for tens of millions of dollars per seat. The U.S. and Russian space agencies are still working on a long-term plan in which a Russian would launch on a SpaceX capsule beginning this fall, and an American would fly up on the Soyuz. That would permit a U.S. and Russian station presence at all times. VandeHei, 55, a retired Army colonel, moved into the space station last April, launching on a Soyuz from Kazakhstan with Pyotr Dubrov and another Russian. He and Dubrov stayed twice as long as usual to help with a Russian film crew that visited in October. As the situation 420 kilometers below became worse last month, VandeHei said he was avoiding discussions about Ukraine with Dubrov and Anton Shkaplerov, their Russian commander. Three more Russians will launch from Kazakhstan on Friday to replace them. "We haven't talked about that too much. I'm not sure we really want to go there, Vandehey told a TV reporter in mid-February. Space station operations continue as always, in orbit and on Earth, according to NASA. It would be a sad day for international operations if we can't continue to peacefully operate in space, said NASA's human spaceflight chief, Kathy Leaders, who noted it would be very difficult to do space research alone. I'm John Russell.
Scientists have discovered that a giant tortoise on one of Ecuador's Galapagos Islands is really a new species that had been misidentified earlier. Ecuador's Galapagos National Park announced the findings from a recent study. Researchers from Newcastle University in England, Yale University in the United States, and the Galapagos Conservancy, an American nonprofit group, carried out the study. The researchers said the giant tortoises living on San Cristobal Island had been identified with the scientific name of Chelonoidis chathamensis. But the researchers now recognize them as genetically different species, the park said in a statement. The scientists concluded that nearly 8,000 tortoises, which exist today on San Cristobal, are not Chelonoidis chathamensis, park officials said. They added that the tortoises appear to be a completely new lineage that has yet to be described. Researchers made the discovery through a genetic comparison of the animals with a sample from the already described species. The lineage, once thought to belong to the San Cristobal tortoises, may belong to a species that disappeared from the island. It may have lived at the same time as the surviving lineage, the statement said. The team of investigators is recovering more DNA from the species thought to be extinct to clarify the state of the tortoises, the statement said. It is not clear how the two species, the one that is still on the island and the one that disappeared forever, are related. The researcher's statement said the name should be given to the extinct species and a new name should be given to the living tortoises. Genetic studies of surviving Galapagos tortoises began in 1995. 4 years later, scientists began studying samples from extinct species of the animals. The researchers said at least 14 species from the islands have been described by science. The study appeared in the publication Heredity last month. The researchers said understanding the history of the giant tortoises on San Cristobal Island could increase knowledge of how the animals developed across the Galapagos. The animal life of the Galapagos Islands is famous for influencing scientist Charles Darwin's development of the theory of evolution. That is the idea that species change over large amounts of time. Scientists have studied the unusual species of animals on the islands, which are an internationally recognized protected area. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
The National Cherry Blossom Festival is celebrating its 110th anniversary. The popular event celebrating U.S.-Japanese ties is once again being held in person. The most flowers are expected between March 22nd and March 25th. The National Cherry Blossom Festival is being held in Washington, D.C., after 2 years of restrictions because of COVID-19. This year, more than ever, you really understand why the festival is so important, said Diana Mayhew. She is the president of the National Cherry Blossom Festival, Incorporated, the nonprofit group that helps organize the events. We recognize that it's more than just a festival. It's about spring and renewal and a sense of new beginnings. The National Park Service helps oversee the festival. The service estimates the cherry trees will have the most flowers, a time called peak bloom, between March 22nd and 25th. The special events start with the opening ceremony on March 20th. They continue through April 17th with musical shows and other events like a parade on Saturday, April 9th. Mike Litters is a spokesman for the Park Service. He said although there was cold weather and snow recently, it would not hurt the cherry blossoms. Temperatures below freezing can damage the blooms. In 2017, a late frost destroyed almost 50% of the flowers. Trees in some areas of Washington have already started to blossom. However, the cherry trees around the tidal basin near the center of the city, have not begun to flower. The area is a favorite place for tourists and photographers. Litters said the blossoms are still firmly inside of their buds. He said the buds act like an armor, giving the blossoms protection. If temperatures are lower next week, there might be some problems, he said, adding, I think we'll be okay this time. For the past 2 years, large gatherings and crowds have been restricted because of the COVID-19 health emergency. City officials closed streets and public transportation around the tidal basin to block people from observing the pink-colored blossoms. The festival organizers worked hard to create safe ways for people to enjoy the yearly celebration of spring, including live videos and internet presentations. This year, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser declared, "We want D.C. to be the face of spring for the nation." This year also marks the 110th anniversary of the gift of 3,000 Japanese cherry trees presented in 1912 by the mayor of Tokyo to the nation's capital. Japan's government remains deeply involved in the festival and often exchanges about 90 old trees for new ones every year. Ryo Karaishi of the Japanese embassy joked at this year's festival announcement that "It feels a little strange to have all these people right in front of me instead of little Zoom squares." Mayhew, the festival's president, said this year will include a joint event with usual and video experiences for those who are still not sure about attending public gatherings or traveling to the event. Mayhew said, "We're spreading it out and being as cautious and as health conscious as possible. There's so many people who want to connect, even if they can't make it." Popular activities will return this year. They include Bloom Cam, live video of the cherry blossoms. Petal porches is an activity where people living in the city decorate the front of their homes with pictures and objects that look like cherry blossoms. The results are shown on the internet. The popular March 26th Kite Flying Festival will take place, as it has in the past, in the area surrounding the Washington Monument. But locals can hold their own kite flying events in areas where it is permitted. I'm Faith Perlow.
Nations around the world have already established economic, cultural, and travel restrictions on Russia. Now, colleges across the United States are facing pressure to put in place educational limits against the country. The restrictions could affect the exchange of students between the two countries, and they could end research projects that receive money from universities in the U.S. For many American colleges, the first concern has been to bring American students studying in Russia or Ukraine home. About 1,400 Americans studied in those nations in 2018, but the numbers have dropped sharply during the pandemic. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Middlebury College in Vermont suspended a study abroad program in Russia at the end of February. The school urged the 12 students to return home immediately for safety reasons. Among them was Xavier Ridgely of Tulane University in New Orleans. Ridgely said he was sad to leave. He called the program in Moscow the opportunity of a lifetime. Other schools like Dartmouth College of New Hampshire are canceling future study programs in Russia, and some are ending financial and educational ties in the country. Soon after the invasion,
The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, said it was ending its partnership with a school in Moscow called Skoltech, an English language technology university it helped start in 2011. MIT officials called it a rejection of the unacceptable military actions against Ukraine. The University of Colorado said it was giving up all investments, including $3.5 million in Russia. The move came after Colorado state leaders urged the school to cut ties. In the state of Arizona, all public universities said they were ending ties with Russia, and Arizona State University said its business school will end connections with a training center in Moscow. State leaders in Ohio and Virginia have also asked their public universities to end investments in Russia. Stanford University, however, is not ending its $1.6 million Russian contract for computer-based business courses. The university said it is in full compliance with the U.S. restrictions. The 2021 Open Doors report said about 5,000 students from Russia studied in the U.S. last year. In addition, just under 2,000 Ukrainian students were in the U.S. Following the invasion, a few American lawmakers pushed for visa restrictions against Russian students. One even called for sending Russian students home. Speaking to CNN last month, Representative Eric Swalwell said the U.S. should consider sending every Russian student out of the United States. Supporters of international education say losing those students would end a chance for them to learn Western ideals. They say Russians who study in America are already more likely to want changes back home. Jill Welch is a senior advisor for a group of university presidents called the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Leaders need to make a distinction between Putin and Russian people who want a better life, she said, mentioning Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sending anyone back wouldn't shorten the war by a day. That is a concern for Ludmila Fedorova, a professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Fedorova was born in Russia and studied in Moscow.
It's extremely important not to cut ties with Russia, because most of the students who do come to study English, they oppose the regime. And actually, especially now, there will be many students from Russia applying for American programs.
Fedorova told VOA that she worries about the exchange of ideas between the U.S. and Russia if study programs are shut down.
I know that the most important thing now is the war in Ukraine, but I'm also very much concerned about my friends in Russia who fight for peace and who find themselves in danger, and there is no escape for them.
I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On today's show, we talk about an idiom involving fish and a pond. A pond is a small body of water. It is usually smaller than a lake. And our idiom today is to be a big fish in a small pond. A big fish in a small pond describes a person who is very well known or important in a small group, but is not known or important outside that small group. For example, a high-performing high school student in a small town could be a big fish in a small pond. He may feel overly confident or overly important, or he may simply not know how small his pond is until he moves on to a big university. He must compete with hundreds of students who were also the best at their high schools. His pond just got much larger and is now filled with many more fish. Here is another example. A young singer was famous in her small town. She wanted to move to a big city to grow her singing career. Her close friends and family supported her, but also warned her. "Here, in our small town," they said, "you are a big fish in a small pond. Once you move to New York City, that is going to change. Best be ready." For some people, this can be a painful realization, sometimes called a wake-up call. Sometimes when we use the expression, a big fish in a small pond, we add words to better describe the fish and the pond. For example, the singer's friends could say that she will be a very small but talented fish in a very big competitive pond. Now, some people like being a big fish in a small pond. They never grow their circle of friends or work environment. Sometimes they do not take opportunities that increase their environment or pond. By staying in a small pond, it is safer. There are fewer dangers and also fewer competitors. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary says that the expression big fish has been slang for an important or influential person since the early 1800s. The addition of in a small pond to mean an unimportant organization is more recent. The dictionary goes on to explain another way to use the idiom a big fish in a small pond. It can also describe a situation in which one person has more power, influence, knowledge, or experience than others within a small group. So sometimes we use this expression to describe people in an insulting way. We are saying that they want to stay in a small pond just to feel more important. Their position of authority is not questioned by the other fish in the pond. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.